I'm really delighted to be here this morning. It's my kind of entree into health research comes through the field of sociology, and in many ways, the presentation, which is going to be brief, it kind of represents a little bit about sociology, but also represents in some ways my training in the field of history, because I really do believe to understand the social determinants of health, or to understand any real, you know, kind of issue of social inequality or what have you, you really need to make appreciable kind of the historical foundations of it. So that's what I want to do today. I'll let you be the judge of how well I do that. I should also say, though, that the three of us kind of coordinated together and are preparing our presentation. So where I kind of trail off in the 1950s, I believe Don's going to pick up, you know, to kind of continue the story. So if I kind of end abruptly, it's because it's kind of part of this larger story that's going to be told here today. But let me first kind of begin with a couple of two little stories that happened to me recently that I hope will provide some context for today's presentation. I teach at Cornell University, which, you know, prides itself as a land-grant institution as being very diverse, but as somebody from the Southwest, having spent a lot of time in California, trust me, it's not diverse. But I recently was at a Cornell Population Center event around issues of health, and I ran into, or I met a colleague for the first time, I think, from the University of Pennsylvania, who was kind of remarking on the fact about, you know, kind of being a little bit befuddled by the fact that American Indians suffer from such tremendous health disparities, because after all, don't we get free health care? So that was the first incident. So, you know, that's kind of been in the back of my head as I've been preparing my presentation. The other kind of recent incident didn't happen at the same event, but happened at a different event where I was talking to a geneticist who was, you know, very keen on trying to kind of partner with Native populations because was convinced and is convinced that genetics really kind of holds the key, you know, to addressing population health disparities, especially for American Indians, and was very proud to kind of cite some of the earlier studies among the then Papago, now Tohono O'odham, you know, kind of the thrifty gene thesis, and, you know, was convinced, you know, that if we kind of look to biology, that's where the answer lies for these issues of obesity and diabetes and all those other things. And I got into a little bit of a heated discussion with him because this does actually connect with my presentation, but the reason why I was a little bit, you know, kind of a little bit more assertive than I normally am in terms of taking people on such issues is I worry that in instances like that, by looking to biology, by looking to genes, it kind of allows us to forget the historical legacy which has created and which continues to perpetuate the disparities. So instead of looking to solutions, perhaps in policy, things, structural inequalities, the answer then is we have this fix-it-all solution. So those are kind of the two little stories that I hope in some ways kind of provide some context to the presentation I have here today. And does this thing, do I click it? Oh, okay. But first, a word from our sponsors. My disclaimer, I have no relationships to disclose or that I'm willing to disclose to this audience or that the APHA cares about. Oh, wait, I'm going the wrong way here. Okay, here we go. I always like to begin with a quote, so I'm gonna give you just a little second to read this one. I think personally that this one really kind of not only helps to kind of situate the presentation that I'm trying to do today, but I think it's really important for those of us, not only those of us that work with Native populations, but I think that work with many underrepresented minority populations, to really kind of, you know, appreciate, you know, the tension that's inherent in looking to genetic solutions versus, you know, kind of those structural factors in terms of trying to resolve these disparities. So I just wanted to kind of start with that quote, because both in turning to genetics, it kind of reflects a certain type of ideology that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, in terms of, you know, the solutions that might actually prevail. But as I said earlier, also kind of, you know, gives us a pass in terms of trying to address those kind of more structural sources of inequality. Oh, wait. I'm not used to using a clicker up here. Okay, so my three objectives for today are I want to provide a context for understanding current health disparities. I also want to make appreciable kind of the ideological basis of these proposed solutions to the Indian problem, in this case, the problem of health. And then I want to just kind of briefly suggest or allude to some of the implications of this for understanding and addressing current health disparities. So, you know, all good stories kind of begin with Christopher Columbus, because as I learned in my history books, you know, that's when America was discovered. It's kind of like, you know, we were lost, but then we were found. But I think starting with Columbus is really important, because I think in this moment, in this particular historical moment, is not to suggest necessarily that the indigenous populations of North America didn't suffer from health issues. You know, I'm not going to kind of paint the rosy picture. We were, you know, frolicking in the woods, all happy and healthy. You know, certainly, you know, issues around, you know, at least seasonal starvation and those types of issues were persistent, but something definitely happened in that historical moment of contact, and that was the introduction of kind of these old world diseases, which had a profound and lasting impact on the indigenous population in North America. And this presentation to the Native Hawaiians and Native Alaskans and others in the room, I apologize, I'm kind of focusing specifically on American Indians, but I think that all of you can kind of appreciate how similar historical legacies, you know, have impacted those populations as well. So what we have here, you know, is kind of this historical moment of contact, and the if you will, almost unintentional introduction of diseases that disseminated nearly 90-95% of the American Indian population. Oh, there I am going backwards again. Prior to contact, though, this is just to kind of give you an idea, and I feel like for some of you, this is kind of like history that you're very familiar with, and so I do apologize. I wasn't quite sure of the audience. But this just gives you an idea of kind of those cultural groups prior to contact. Don, I believe, has some very, I think, very illuminating slides in there which really kind of show the changes in the landscape, or at least the land over time. So in addition to diseases, we also have kind of the introduction of warfare. Warfare, although, you know, certainly became kind of a more prominent feature of U.S. policy and its dealing with the Indian problem, you know, it has even a larger historical legacy. So what we see as pre-contact is we have an American Indian population, which by various estimates has ranged from anywhere from 1.8 to 12 million. But what we see at the end of the introduction of, you know, old world diseases and the result of warfare is we see this near 90-95% decrease in the indigenous population in North America. One specific example is in Hispaniola, for instance, the Arawak population, which was near 400,000 in 1496, and they were the first population that were contacted, less than 100 years later, we're down to 125 individuals. And today, we still have these discussions, and the legacy of this in some ways is, you know, there's a lot of debate whether or not, you know, the Arawak as a people still exists. There are people that claim ancestry, but, you know, there's certainly some discussion and debate whether or not, you know, they were actually extinct or if there's still kind of a legacy in terms of their ancestors. Oh, okay, left click, okay. What we find as a result of kind of the introduction of old world diseases and warfare is kind of this really, I think it's an interesting attitude. This is a quote that came from one of these reports. Those large and goodly territories, deserted as it were by natural inhabitants, should be possessed and enjoyed as such by our subjects and our people. So here's where we kind of see a couple of different things. In this particular quote, we see kind of this ideology of religion, which helps to kind of inform almost this inevitability, if you will, that of course the indigenous population would be disseminated by diseases because they're a weaker, they're an inferior population. And so kind of this justification, you know, for, you know, the near, you know, genocide of the indigenous habitants is kind of, you know, couched in this term, this language of religion, which we will definitely see later, you know, in the reservation era with missionization. But it also helped to kind of justify what later became, and it won't be a part of this presentation, but kind of these, you know, ideas around race. Ideas around, you know, kind of the racial inferiority and superiority of some of different peoples. it also helped to kind of perpetuate, you know, because it was of the force of God, you know, that kind of cleared the land of these people. It also, we see it later kind of perpetuated in this notion of manifest destiny. This particular photograph or this particular image I really like because it captures so much there. But this idea that, you know, kind of, you know, moving westward, it implies a lot of different things. You know, the righteousness and the inevitability, if you will, of westward expansion. And you see the natives fleeing at the front. And, you know, kind of the religious ideology behind it. But what we don't see is, you know, part of that ability of that westward expansion was certainly as a result of intentional warfare. This is an image that was painted to depict the Sand Creek Massacre. So we see, you know, kind of the ideology of religion, this inevitability, but at the same time, we see kind of policies that are also being enacted by the federal government, you know, to help kind of pave the way, if you will, for westward expansion. And I took the time to write these nice little cards, and now I'm lost. I'm not flipping them on time. Okay, so I think I'm here. Another example from the Trail of Tears, this idea that natives somehow voluntarily or through, you know, their own inability to kind of, you know, combat disease and warfare, this inevitability that the superior race was then therefore kind of preordained to inhabit the landscape. What we see, though, in this kind of this era of manifest destiny in 1783, we see the Indian Removal Act, the Trail of Tears here, relocated large groups of natives, the Cherokee, the Creek, and other groups from the U.S. South to what has now become Indian Territory in Oklahoma. But we also see kind of the creation of the reservation system. The implications, when you think about the reservation system in terms of, you know, the health implications and the legacy of it, may not necessarily be obvious at first, but I think as we start to kind of peel back the layers of the onion and kind of think a little bit more critically, we can begin to see a couple of different things happen. Not only have natives been, you know, dispossessed of their land and they've been relocated off of their Aboriginal homelands, thereby beginning kind of this severing, if you will, of the cultural connection that people have to their land, as well as the ability to sustain themselves by their livelihood based upon that landscape, relocated now into new and in many ways very foreign areas. We also see, you know, the introduction of kind of the mission or the Christian boarding schools. Kind of, I grew up in the Southwest, and you know, we had Mormons, we had Baptists, we had all kinds of different groups that were out there. But in many ways, you know, the mission schools, it's almost as if they divided up Indian country, if you will, and kind of gave different portions of it to different Christian denominations. But all of them, in many ways, kind of their intent was to assimilate American Indians through the process of Christianization and education. And to be, I think, fair here, and I'm trying to kind of give a balanced presentation and not valorize natives and completely, you know, portray westward expansion and the federal government in an entirely negative light. I think that, you know, when we consider the choices that people made, both in terms of the government and native response to it, choices constrained. So while today we may sit here and we may think, well, you know, well, they shouldn't have done that, they should have done this, I think that we need to kind of recognize that choice is always constrained. And so when you think about, you know, kind of the reservation and the boarding schools, well, why did natives, you know, participate in that system? Oftentimes the choice was, you know, hunger and starvation in their home communities versus the opportunity to be fed and clothed and sheltered. The consequences, though, particularly in relationship to boarding schools, we see this huge, huge population of young Native children that are dying as a result of tuberculosis. And if we think about this in terms of kind of changes in lifestyle, people are now kind of being moved and into cramped quarters. We see it happening on reservations. And so we see the rise of these diseases, which in many ways they're communicable diseases that are kind of in this ideal environment, if you will, because of the close proximity on the reservation or in boarding schools.
Many of these reservation boarding schools, I don't have any images here today, but if you ever get a chance to visit them, you'll see these large, large cemeteries, usually adjacent to the boarding school. And if you go through and you can kind of, you know, begin to kind of track, you know, the waves of different diseases that kind of pass through the population, and, you know, the I won't say near annihilation, but, you know, this incredibly high mortality rate as a result of a lot of these communicable diseases that occurred in the boarding school. Boarding schools, as I said, you know, were also intended to kind of, you know, assimilate American Indians. You know, lots of good research that talks about, you know, kill the Indian, save the man. And I think for many Indian reformers, there was a very, I think, profound belief that this was good for natives, that this was the one and best way to kind of ensure the survival of native people by having them assimilate into the mainstream of culture and society, kind of, you know, become property owners, you know, become, you know, kind of contributing citizens as of white mainstream society. Here we have, I think that this is going to be familiar to many of you. I like this photo because we see a group of Apache children at Carlisle Indian School as they arrive wearing the traditional clothes. 4 months later, we see them, you know, kind of the literal transformation, the beginning of this transformative process. Yes, you know, very symbolic, but, you know, that transformation, you know, the eradication of, or the near elimination of the traditional language for many of those students in those boarding schools, introduction of new diets, you know, more formalized education, lots of different things that happened in that also do have kind of a health impact in terms of, you know, just shifts in population, which I hope to say a little bit about. And I realize I don't have a clock here, so how far?
15 minutes.
Oh, see how fast it goes? I thought, okay, I'm going to keep this very, very short. I'm gonna try and wrap it up because I'm hoping that we'll have some good conversation and discussion after this. But the point of this particular one is, you know, oftentimes the explanations of the cause of diseases or the dissemination of the population as well as the solutions, in many ways were referential and strategic to U.S. polity and society. So if we think about, you know, the removal and the reservation era, it served certain needs. It served the needs of, you know, kind of a westward and this expanding kind of non-native population. You know, we see, you know, a number of different federal policies in that period, the Indian Reorganization Act, the General Allotment Act to dissolve collectively held tribal lands, you know, make Indians into individual landholders. So we see a lot of different policies that are really kind of undercutting traditional society and traditional kind of living patterns among Native people. So here we start to kind of move into the area that I think Dawn is going to pick up on, so I'm going to kind of quickly breeze through this. But throughout all of this, you know, concerns around Native health continue to persist. The solution to it has always kind of waxed and waned, from benign neglect to, you know, actual programs and policies that were to address those health issues. But, you know, in the 1930s and 40s, you know, the concerns around health, the persistence of tuberculosis, especially in reservation populations, federal officials became increasingly concerned about this. At this point, the Bureau of Indian Affairs had been transferred from the War Department into the newly formed Department of the Interior, which in itself, you know, should raise some questions because of the inherent tensions in the Department of the Interior. So on the one hand, the Interior, who's supposed to be looking out for the best interests of Native people, at the same time are also responsible and accountable to federal legislators, many of them from the West, who also had interests in those same lands that, you know, the same agency is supposed to be protecting and preserving for Native people. So there's this inherent tension there. These are just a couple of slides that I just want to kind of quickly go through because I do recognize that I'm going beyond my 15 minutes here. To just kind of bring it up, I'm taking this huge leap in time, but I kind of wanted to conclude with this slide. This is a quote from Senator Daniel Inouye. As he was kind of looking at the 1990s and kind of this push towards kind of these block grant programs,
And what I like about this quote is I think Enaway certainly appreciates kind of the historical legacy behind other policies that have in many ways kind of been couched in terms to provide and assist Native people. And I appreciate the fact that he's deeply suspicious of these block grants and what it may signal in terms of relieving, if you will, the federal trust responsibility to providing health services and other services to Native people. So reconnecting it to my colleague's earlier comment about, you know, this free Indian health care, one, it's not free. there was it's based in treaty, it's based on the cession of land. And so this idea that somehow it's a federal handout program and that we as Native people should somehow be grateful for it, you know, that it's a freebie without kind of recognizing the fact that, you know, as Native people, you know, we have definitely paid the price for this. I think it allows us to kind of forget that legacy. I also think, you know, particularly as we look at, you know, the past decade or two with the rapid proliferation and development of tribal government gaming, there were earlier conversations that many of you might have been familiar with or have heard about, where there was a great deal of discussion around means testing. In terms of the allocation of federal funds to Indian tribes. The idea behind means testing is for those tribes that have these very profitable casinos that now they have the means to provide for their own health care, and therefore the federal government shouldn't have to provide for that health care. Again, you know, it's kind of a, to me, it's an indication of this historical amnesia, if you will, of the basis and the legacy and why it's so important to remember this, because, you know, means testing, at least in my personal feeling, it never should enter into the discussion that, you know, there is a historical basis, you know, for providing these services and by creating a situation where those that are most able to provide for themselves should provide for themselves, I think is kind of a convenient dismissal of the history here. In terms of implications, just to kind of briefly connect it to, you know, this 95% decrease in the American Indian population as a result of contact. Now, depending on how and what definition you use for American Indian, American Indians now today comprise, you know, anywhere from 2 to 4, 6% of the total U.S. population. So we haven't seen the recovery, despite this incredibly high fertility rate. And if you look at the population charts, we have a very young population. But clearly, you know, for people who were the Aboriginal inhabitants of this land, that were 100% of the population, that today that we're less than 4%, I think kind of speaks very loudly to these inherent disparities, and by extension, the implication that when, you know, it comes time to dividing up the federal money or time to start, you know, developing policies to address population needs, as 4% of the population, it's real easy to kind of overlook this, to forget it, to excuse it, because it's not going to make a significant difference given the vastness of the U.S. population. We now see kind of new chronic diseases, which are a legacy of kind of inadequate health care. We see, you know, all kinds of, you know, rates around diabetes and obesity and kind of those comorbidities that I think that you can trace to the earlier period of the reservation time and the introduction of kind of non-indigenous foods, processed flour, those types of things. And kind of the irony of it is, I'm sure some of you have seen the t-shirt about or heard the comment about, you know, fry bread being traditional Indian food. That's always a head scratcher for me because, again, I think it's a little bit of this historical amnesia because processed white flour, you know, if you think about it, was not part of, you know, our indigenous diet, and yet, you know, for many of us, you know, we kind of see fry bread and, you know, kind of traditional Native food. I think it's also kind of perpetuated this dependency on the federal government. And while I myself, you know, believe very strongly in sovereignty and self-determination, I'm always mindful of the fact that there's a certain contingency to it, if you will. And if you think back not too long ago on the termination era, with literally a stroke of the congressional pen, we had tribes that were terminated because they were deemed, you know, to have been, you know, assimilated enough, you know, to no longer be considered Native. And so when I think about tribal sovereignty and I go to a lot of these meetings and I hear tribal people talk about, you know, the importance of sovereignty, I agree that it's important, but I think that we need to be mindful of the fact that it's a contingent type of sovereignty.
when we talk about it in terms of our relationship with the federal government. It's based in many ways on their recognition, and I think for those groups now that are trying to gain federal recognition, they can definitely appreciate kind of the tenuousness of it. But we also see this, you know, chronic poverty and unemployment that continues to persist on reservations, which far exceed national averages for similar populations. So those are kind of my implications, and I'm hoping that Don and Kelly pick up on this. But I thought, I can't end on a downer, can I? And I was looking for some kind of an uplifting quote, and in the absence of an uplifting quote, I wanted to share a photo from, these are my little nephews. And I like this photo because it reminds me of the reason why this work is important to me. And although you don't know my nephews, I hope that, you know, it reminds all of us of the importance, and to take seriously, you know, that there are important implications to our work, and we really need to think about our future generations. So I will leave it there, and thank you very much.